Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I am Sher Ali Tareen, your host. In his majestic and encyclopedic new book, Slavery in Islam, Jonathan Brown presents a sweeping analysis of Muslim intellectual, political, and social entanglements with slavery, and some of the thorniest conceptual and ethical problems involved in defining and writing about slavery. Self-reflective and bold, Slavery in Islam also offers a remarkable combination of intellectual and social history, anchored in layers of complex yet eminently accessible textual analysis. What makes talking about slavery so difficult? What are the dominant discourses on and attitudes about slavery that have dominated Muslim history? What are some of the major points of overlap and fissure between Western and Muslim understandings of slavery? And how one must confront the ethical and interpretive challenges brought about by the presence of slavery in Islam? These are among the questions Brown explores and addresses in this monumental work of scholarship that is sure to spark many conversations and debates within and outside Islamic studies. Here now is my conversation with Professor Jonathan Brown. Hello, Jonathan. How are you doing?
Hey, how are you doing? Nice to talk to you again.
Great to have you on the New Books Network and on New Books in Islamic Studies. As I was saying before we started recording our conversation, this is such an encyclopedic masterpiece, Jonathan. So really, I think this book will be much discussed, debated, and it's a really fascinating and a very detailed read. So thanks for this. I was wondering if we can perhaps begin, since you've been on the New Books Network before, so people have a sense of your journey into Islamic studies, but I was wondering if I could ask you how you got to write this particular book.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks a lot for having me on, and for, you know, I know it takes a lot of time to read these books, and so I really appreciate it. This book is have a long time coming, and that when I wrote my previous book was called Misquoting Muhammad, The Challenging Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy, and it's kind of about kind of Sunni intellectual history, especially hermeneutics and dealing with the challenges of interpretation and kind of clash between truth inside of scripture and truth outside of scripture and how you reconcile these two. So the last chapter I kind of wanted to tackle what I consider to be sort of the ultimate moral hermeneutic problems that challenges that Muslims face today. And one was the issue of wife beating. So from Mukran verse 434, that talks about striking wives. And the second issue is slavery. I see these as kind of the two ultimate, like I said, moral hermeneutic challenges. I wrote the last chapter on wife beating, but I it was just not feasible for me to do something on slavery. I just didn't know enough. I knew essentially nothing about the topic, and I didn't have the time or the space. So I kind of put that off, and that was, you know, maybe 2012, 2013, around that time. And then ISIS happened, and the whole issue of ISIS and enslavement of minorities and sex slavery of Yazidi women and girls, that happened. And so it really kind of, before this issue had been there, and I think Muslims had found it challenging, but I mean, this, but sort of, I think a lot of the people just ignored it or didn't really think about it or weren't asked about it a lot. But then when ISIS happened, it really kind of blew this into the mainstream and really became a real issue of challenge for a lot of Muslims, or people even talking about Islamic studies. And so I wanted to talk about this, to bring this issue up. I wanted to write something about it. And so I did, and I work with a group called Yaqeen Institute, which we do kind of stop clarifying issues of controversy and sort of targets of Islamophobia. We, you know, write things online that are meant to be kind of accessible, but accurate, but accessible. And so I wrote something on the kind of issue of defining slavery for that. And then I realized that this is just not something you can write like a series of online essays about. You have to deal with it comprehensively. And so that's where this book came from. Sort of the answer, I guess, well, actually, I should go back and say that, I mean, really this book started when I first became Muslim, when I was in college. And in fact, I even start the book with this, you know, that I was basically, you know, one day just reading a translation of the Quran, and it came across these verses in Surah An-Nahl that talk about where the Quran uses slavery as sort of the parable of like a man who's rich versus a man who's a slave and has no power. And just sort of using this parable to talk about God, you know, God versus false gods and idols. But I was struck because I thought to myself, I was, you know, wait a second, how can the Quran just mention this and not say, you know, slavery is evil or slavery is wrong? How can this just be so mundane it doesn't even get mentioned? And then, of course, there's lots of other times in the Quran that slavery is mentioned or slaves are mentioned. And so, you know, I think like a lot of people, you know, I just had this, I didn't understand how this could be allowed or go unremarked on. So you know, it kind of became like a real issue for me. And I think eventually I really wanted to write about it and deal with it. And so that this book is kind of an answer to that, to those questions.
Now, in the introduction in the first chapter, you spend a lot of time and a lot of thought into the whole question of defining this category of slavery. And a question that runs throughout the book is this question of, is it possible to have a trans-historical definition of this idea of slavery or not? And after going through multiple possibilities, you end chapter one by saying, yes, slavery does exist, but with a lot of caveats and a lot of nuances attached to that. So without going into all the details, I was wondering if you could choose perhaps a couple of major factors or problems that are associated with defining this category or answering the question, which is the question of chapter one's title, does slavery exist? What are two sort of major problems or issues at hand in relation to slavery in the Islamic tradition or more broadly?
Yeah, boy, that's a tough topic. So basically what I realize is you can't really talk about this topic without kind of going back to first principles. You can't, I mean, you can talk about it, people do all the time, but you can't really have a profound kind of moral, almost like moral ontological discussion about this issue without really questioning the terms you use and where they come from and how we think about them. I one of the things I analogize it to in the first chapter is the issue of terrorism. It's sort of, I think it's sort of like terrorism, right? So once you introduce the word terrorism into a conversation, you can't really have, the whole conversation is skewed after that. You can't really talk about, well, you know, this group is a terrorist group. You can't then say, well, but, you know, they're not that bad, or, you know, but what about, you know, they also feed people, or, you know, so it the discourse becomes completely shaped by the term, and the term is deeply politicized, right? We all know, you know, one person's terrorist, another person's freedom fighter. So I kind of wanted to use that as an analogy to show how terms can really, once they're introduced, if they're not looked at critically from the beginning, they can really shape discourse sort of irretrievably. The second thing about this, I think, analogous to terrorism or terrorism studies is that terrorism is a term that is there has no agreed upon definition. So it's an unusual feature where, well, actually, it's not that unusual, right? So like religious studies, for example, I mean, there's a number of fields that deal with the central object of investigation is actually kind of undefined, or there's no agreed upon definition, or that a discussion about its definition plunges you immediately into the kind of irreconcilable or seemingly irreconcilable divisions within the field itself. So something like, what is terrorism? What is slavery? And so, you know, sure enough, within slavery studies, there's a whole debate about whether there actually is one thing transhistorically across history that you can call slavery, that you can be talking about slavery in the ancient Near East and slavery in medieval China and slavery in the Americas in the 19th century. And really, can you actually have one conversation about slavery? Or are you talking about different phenomena and sort of imposing some unified term to join them? That's one school. The other school of thought, which is the majority, would say, yes, of course, there's something transhistorical called slavery, but then the end issue of how you define that. So the first chapter kind of runs through these debates. And, it sort of starts out by talking about questions of realism, moral realism, or even philosophical realism versus sort of discourse construction or nominalism, where, you know, is there actually something out there in the universe? Is there a reality out there in the universe, or are we just constructing reality in our language and in our communication with one another? And so I talk about how kind of definition is the first step of that, and then discourse formation. This is all well-known, well-trodden territory. So then I talk about, you know, what are the challenges of defining slavery transhistorically. It's relatively easy to define slavery within a society or within a legal system or even within a civilization. But to define slavery kind of globally and transhistorically is really difficult because the terms that we would use sort of historically would be, we talk about freedom, we being kind of the West and also the Islamic tradition as a Western tradition, right? So we would use terms like freedom. So slavery is not being free. We would use terms like a person as property. And I show that, that both these concepts, freedom and property, are so ambiguous and contextually determined that if you want to take them out of context and use and talk about them transhistorically, you have a problem, which is that the terms are so vague, they don't mean anything, right? So freedom is just, being a slave is just having more restrictions on your freedom than a free person has. And exactly how many more restrictions or what those restrictions are really depends on where you are. So that doesn't really help. And being property, how would you even define property? You know, property is some strong degree of control over something. You could talk about it more clearly in the, you know, common law tradition or Islamic tradition, but across continents and centuries, you're just left with some degree of control over something else. And so a slave is somebody who somebody else has some degree of control over, which again, pretty much is almost any relationship we can imagine. So what I talk about is how really a lot of slavery studies is, and this is, there's a lot of debate about and like reflexive awareness about this in slavery studies. So I don't want to, I'm not acting like I'm coming out of, you know, the blue and saying, hey, let me, you know, I'm going to sort of do an Edward Saidian orient, you know, analysis of your field and tell you what's wrong with it. I wouldn't presume to do that. I'm just not qualified to do that. But so I really kind of drew on the internal discourse within slavery studies itself in doing this. So one of the problems is that really, I think when we kind of Western Academy talk about slavery transhistorically or globally, we're really sort of, we know what slavery is. It's sort of, we, you know, slavery is like there's people in chains and there's people on auction blocks and there's people getting whipped and people, you know, there's a, maybe there's a lot of times a racial element and a notion of darker people being enslaved and there's trauma and all these things. And, a very clear kind of racial or phenotypical distinction between the slaver and the enslaved. And so when what we really do is sort of we go around world history and kind of look for things that match that appear to be the same thing. And we try to come up with definitions that kind of work to put everything that we think is slavery inside the definition and keep everything outside of, it's not slavery outside that definition. But when something doesn't fit, we sort of either make an exception for it or we adjust our definition a little bit. But then you get to the issue which Ibn Taymiyyah brings up really well, which is, what exactly is definition doing then? I mean, if your definition is really just sort of being stretched or tightened when you come across something that you want to put inside or outside the definition, you actually know what it is you're talking about. And you're just trying to create a, the definition is just sort of a crutch, a scholarly crutch that you use to articulate that sense of what this thing is. It's already in your mind. So what is that thing that's already in our mind? And I talk about how that is sort of our Atlantic experience, North Atlantic experience of slavery and European enslavement of Africans.
Now, I actually want to turn to chapter 4 before coming to 2 and 3 to continue this sort of line of conversation. And sort of the question I want to ask you is this category that you spent a lot of time discussing in chapter 4, what you call the slavery conundrum. And the two things that I found particularly interesting in this chapter is, one, the comparison that you made about sort of the American traditions of slavery and confronting that past and the Islamic tradition. And you sort of talk about two advantages and also disadvantages, or, you know, problems or also possibilities or avenues that open up. And you talk about ways in which, you know, as much as you have discussions of the category of slavery in Islamic law, they're not tied to the category of race per se, whereas that is the case in the American tradition or history. But on the other hand, in the Islamic tradition, there is a certain sacrality associated with these traditions around slavery. So there is both advantages and disadvantages. And then the second thing that I found really interesting was to sort of touch on what you were saying about slavery studies, that, you know, arguments like the category of freedom or bondage or so on, that these being fluid categories are something that is quite acceptable in slavery studies. In fact, as you mentioned on one instance, these are actually quite banal points now. But in the popular imaginary, saying that these things are ambiguous create a lot more controversy. So anyways, I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners a bit, what is this slavery conundrum? And how then do you sort of negotiate it in your own writing in this chapter, as you traverse American traditions, Islamic traditions, slavery studies, and popular responses as you present them through sort of anonymous screenshots and social media comments and so on?
So basically, when I was writing the book, I felt really challenged about how I was going to organize, but how I was going to talk about this knot of topics you mentioned. And I remember I was in Turkey. It was the summer of 2017. And then that was when the Charlottesville protests happened. I remember watching them on the news, or, you know, like seeing kind of social media discussions about them. And there was this discussion where Tucker Carlson on Fox News, he comes out and he says, he was talking about the statue of Thomas Jefferson and how people want to take it down because Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner and, you know, had sex with his female slave and had children with her or whatever. And he's also the architect of the American Republic and the writer of the Declaration of Independence and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So, and he sort of, he says, yes, slavery is evil. In fact, you know, if you believe in the rights of individuals, there's not anything more evil than it. But it's also, was also totally normal in the past. And so pretty much everybody did it, like Plato and Aristotle and Muhammad, peace be upon him, even says peace be upon him. And so therefore, you know, we kind of accept it. And I just thought, like, look at the glaring contradiction here, right? So if you're saying something is the you know, pretty much the most evil thing we can imagine in history, then you sort of just whitewash it. Oh, well, actually, it was a moral taint and, you know, we kind of just look past it. Look, if you're going to look to somebody for inspiration to, you know, someone you're going to say, this person is going to be the sort of inspiration for our political moral view of our polity, or this person is going to be inspiration for my philosophy or for my religion, how would you accept that this person thought slavery was okay? I mean, again, like I have had this discussion with so many people over the course of this writing this book, and I ask people, I always ask them the same question. If somebody came to give you moral advice or religious advice, and then they said, also, I think slavery is totally fine, would you take advice from them? I mean, no, you would think that they're a monster. You would not consider them to be a person who you could even converse with in good company. So why, you know, but here's the, this is the conundrum, which is that essentially every religious and philosophical tradition prior to the basically late 1600s or 1700s didn't really have a problem with something called slavery. So there's no religious or philosophical tradition that is free of this major fault. So this is what I call the slavery conundrum. And this conundrum, by the way, I want to make it clear, this isn't a real conundrum. This is a conundrum that is created by the way that we in the modern West talk about the issue of slavery. So we kind of, it's a conundrum we create for ourselves. And I think one of the reasons that people have a really hard time discussing this. And of course, I acknowledge that slavery is a cause of like massive trauma for people and still affects societies. But in terms of intellectual discussion, like I think one of the reasons that it's so hard for people to talk about is because people have a sort of a sense that there's internal contradictions, or when you point that out, it becomes very stressful for people. They don't want to acknowledge that or to address that. So the features of the slavery, there's three, the slavery conundrum is that there's three axioms, and these all are true. But they also cannot actually be held at the same time. So they're mutually contradictory. So the first one is that slavery is a gross and intrinsic evil. So again, how do we know this is true? Just go to a cocktail party and try and say anything good about slavery, or that, you know, it's not that bad or whatever. I mean, you're going to get, you know, this will not be accepted. The second feature or second axiom is that slavery is slavery. All slavery is slavery. So there's no good slavery and bad slavery. Again, imagine sort of talking about slavery in a cocktail party and saying, "Well, this slavery issue wasn't that bad." You would immediately be called an apologist for slavery. And the third feature or the third axiom is that our past has some degree of moral or even legal authority over us. And so we don't, you know, if we could actually be totally consistent and say, you know, yes, slavery is a gross and intrinsic evil. Yes, all slavery is slavery. And so, yeah, basically anybody who endorsed anything that we see as slavery in the past, we're just going to throw into the kind of historical garbage bin of a morally compromised individuals or morally compromised traditions and not deal with them, you know, move on from there. But the fact is that people, whether they're Christians or Muslims or Jews or Americans, right, who think about the Constitution, the last axiom is based on the idea that whether you're coming from a religious tradition or kind of a philosophical tradition or a political tradition, people don't want to condemn their past to the moral garbage dump or to moral obsolescence. Hang on, Hashim, in fadlik ana ad ahki bi telefon, fa mumkin ahki iqfal al bab warak. Okay, shukran. So that's like the what I call the moral the slavery conundrum. And there's a sort of American slavery conundrum and the Islamic slavery conundrum, and they're actually very similar, except that the American one is the Muslim one in some ways is more difficult because, you know, in theory you could be American and say, well, you know, Thomas Jefferson was a very compromised person or something like that. But in, you know, in the Islamic tradition, if you say that Hashim, I can't talk. You have to go. Hashim, I know. I can't. And ask you the telephone. I understand that. And ask you the telephone. And I'm a muqabila. Okay. And the mishmuz. La taqtani. Don't interrupt me, please. I'm sorry about that. I know this is probably horrible, but so the in some ways the Islamic tradition is the Islamic kind of slavery conundrum is really in this way implacable, I guess, or unresolvable, because if you say that the Prophet Muhammad, or that's really great, guys, but I'm in the middle of I know, I understand that. I can't have this happen. I'm sorry. I'm talking on a doing interview and I can't keep having interruptions. Sorry. He just built a gingerbread house and really wants me to see it. And it's like, Okay, so I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to have this like make any sense when you put it together. But I would just say that the Islamic conundrum is in some ways much more difficult, because to morally impugn the founder of the Islamic tradition, in this case, you know, God and the Prophet Muhammad, you end up with something that is either technically kufr, technically unbelief. So if you were to, you know, go to any Muslim scholar in history that I know of and say, I think the Prophet Muhammad committed a major egregious moral sin, or even worse than that, he committed this and didn't even know it was wrong, you would not be Muslim anymore. And in addition, even if we put aside the kind of technicalities, why are you taking religious and moral advice from guidance from somebody who either was okay with slavery or didn't even know that it was not, that it was evil and should, that he should not have been okay with it, right? So that's the real intense dispensation of the Islamic slavery conundrum.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let's switch to chapter 2, in which you talk about slavery in the Sharia. And so if you could perhaps describe a bit some of the sort of dominant discourses and attitudes on this category of fiqh in the Sharia. And then you also talk about some very interesting ambiguities about describing slaves as property, but then they're also human beings. So that creates a fair bit of ambiguity. So I was wondering, so two parts of the question. One is if you could talk a bit about sort of dominant discourses and attitudes and some of these ambiguities. And then how does the discussions on slavery in the Sharia compare to other legal traditions that you also discuss very in quite elaborate ways, the Roman tradition or the other Near Eastern traditions and so on?
Okay, so I think, you know, it's really, here it's really where you get a reminder that Islam is a Western tradition, you know, and obviously an Abrahamic tradition, because after having talked about how, how it's very hard to come up with the trans-historical definition of slavery that works, actually, when you're talking about slavery in the Islamic versus kind of Western tradition, you actually can have a pretty unified conversation, a pretty consistent conversation, because they both really, they're very influenced by obviously the Abrahamic tradition of the Bible and the Quran, but also the Roman legal tradition. And just to be clear, I'm not endorsing the kind of Patricia Crona view that, or even Goldziher view that Islamic law is sort of Roman law. Papered over with Islamic coloring or something. But if there is an area of Islamic law where there is huge import and reliance on pre-Islamic Near Eastern law, especially Roman law, it's definitely the laws on slavery. I mean, without a doubt, there's just major pillars of Sharia tradition on slavery just comes straight out of the Roman Near Eastern tradition. For example, the idea that a slavery is transmitted through the mother. And even Imam Shafi notes this in his he says that, there's a kind of a contradiction here, because in Islamic law, both your lineage, your identity, and your religion come from your father, but your slave status or free status comes from your mother, which he says is like, pretty serious inconsistency. But he would kind of come up with his own explanation for it, which is that, Islam is more important. So it's not, religion is ultimately the most important thing. It's more important than in slave status. So that's why I come to your father. It's sort of not a very convincing explanation. So that's a major feature that that comes from a Roman tradition. But in some ways, also, there's like really good argument against the kind of Goldziher Krona thesis, because Islamic law breaks with Near Eastern Roman law in just absolutely profound ways as well, and does so from the very beginning. Although what's interesting is that some of the most consistent and most important rules regarding slavery in the Sharia actually don't come from the Quran or clearly from any hadiths, so but they're agreed upon immediately. There's no debate about them really, but there's no clear scriptural anchor for them. One is that Muslims cannot be enslaved. And two is that the only route into slavery is capture in warfare. So capture of a non-Muslim who's outside the abode of Islam in warfare by Muslims. That's the only way that someone can get enslaved. You can't be a debt slave. You can't sell yourself into slavery. You can't give your children into slavery. You can't be enslaved for a crime. Although these things happen at various times in Islamic history, they're not technically allowed in the Sharia. And then, of course, another huge break is that whereas all sort of the direction of Near Eastern law and custom regarding slavery was that a child born of a male slave owner and his female slave would be either illegitimate and or a slave, right? So you can't have in pre-Islamic Near East, you don't have someone, a master slave, have sex with his female slave and then a child born, have that child be legitimate and free. The child's either illegitimate and a slave or just a slave, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in Roman law, they had, and Roman law under the Christian church, they had moved towards sort of even allowing you to marry your slave, because they just wanted all sexual activity to be monogamous and within marriage. But there was the idea that you would have a concubine in addition to a wife was simply unacceptable. So Islam kind of just completely goes in the opposite direction, sort of take a 90-degree turn, and says that not only can you have a free wife and a concubine, you can have a free wife and as many slave concubines as you want, but your children born of your slave concubines are actually going to be free, legitimate, and they're going to have the same social standing as a child born of a free wife. So this is like completely unprecedented and a really dramatic break from pre-Islamic tradition. So there's incredible continuities, also incredible changes introduced. And again, these happen kind of just immediately and apparently with very strong consensus amongst Muslim jurists. In terms of ambiguities, I mean, in a way, I mean, I feel cheesy saying this because it's like almost a something you see so often when you read about slavery. You'll see this statement that everybody knows that slavery is sort of an ambiguous status because a slave is both property and a human being. So you have this weird situation where, you're property like a book, but you're also a human being like any other human being. And so there's the status of a slave is very ambiguous and kind of liminal and oscillates between a person and a thing. So you can just see this in Islam. I mean, you could just sit in a book, read a book of fiqh, and you will just get example after example after example after example of this in almost every possible area of law. And I mean, there's a number in the book. I'll give you one that's not in the book because I just came across the other day. I thought it was so interesting, which is when you are, let's say, a free man marries a slave woman. So let's say I have a friend, Ahmed, and I'm always vilifying myself and these, whatever. I have a female slave, and I say, okay, Ahmed, I am going to marry my female slave to you, and now, according to Islamic law, which is just agreed upon essentially by every school of law, as far as I know, if these two, this couple has a child, the child will be a slave because it goes through the mother, and the child will actually belong to me. So question is, who has to pay for that child's maintenance? Or who has to pay for the wife's maintenance even? And you see, like, for example, the Hanbali school of law says, the owner, me, I have to pay for the child and for the wife's maintenance because I am the owner and they are my property. And that sort of supersedes or trumps all other relationships in the situation. The Shafi'i and Maliki school say, no, husbands pay to maintain their wives and they pay to maintain their children. And that is what, you know, this isn't, you know, kind of looks past the slavery issue here and makes it just about a marriage relationship. The Hanafi school says, well, it really depends. So is the wife, slave wife here, is she spending most of her time with her husband, you know, cooking for him and hanging out with him or and living with him? Or does she live with the master and she's actually still working for him most of the time? So it kind of depends on where is she spending most of her time? Where is her domicile? Who is she benefiting? Then that person would cover her expenses. So you can see kind of an oscillation between the property aspect governing everything versus the human relationship aspect. And then almost in the Hanafi one is like, you know, where is the utility going? So this is, you could come up with, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of such examples of the liminality and the oscillation between human and property that you see in cases of slavery and law.
Turning to chapter 3, Slavery in Islamic Civilization, in which you really show the multiple kinds of roles that slaves have performed and adopted in Muslim history and politics. I mean, the multiple subheadings of this chapter include slave as saint, a slave as elite administrator, as soldier, as rebel, as scholar, and so on. Let's talk a bit about the slave as a leader or as an administrator. And you talk about an interesting tension there in that in sort of the Islamic legal tradition, you mentioned that the idea of the slave becoming a ruler over other Muslims is not permissible. But then, of course, we also have examples of former slaves becoming rulers and so on. So speak a bit about how that kind of tension was often resolved and what are some key examples of slaves with political power and authority that we have seen in Muslim history.
So I think this is something that gets, you know, it's sort of like a, I don't know if it's a debate or sort of a settled debate in Mamluk studies or kind of Mamluk era studies where, you know, people will often say, even today, almost, you know, like a at a more undergrad teaching level or, you know, popular writing level to say whether well, there's slave dynasties in Islamic history. So the Mamluks are the whole states run by slaves. And people, other people, especially more, most recently, a scholar named Kobi Yusuf has a great article on this, where he points out that, and it has been pointed out that, in fact, the Mamluk rulers were not slaves, and they didn't call themselves Mamluks, right? They called themselves Dawlat al-Atrak or Dawlat al-Cherkes, the Circassian state or the Turkish state, and that they were, you know, quite clear that they were not slaves, and they made very clear, and they made it sure that it was known that they had been manumitted because, yeah, according to the Sharia, a slave cannot be a ruler, cannot be the head of a state. But where slavery is part of this world and a huge part is that the idiom or the experience that held together this elite system and the system of rule was this idea of importing young slaves from the Turkish tribes or the Circassian tribes or the steppes of Russia or the Caucasus and bringing them in and training them to be elite soldiers. And that system of slaves belonging to a master and those households are what rules the state. So that actually is, slavery is hugely important, even if technically the sultans are not slaves themselves. You do have a few, I think I give one or two instances where someone might actually be a slave, but most of the time these elite administrators or the rulers are not slaves. And this is true for the Mamluks, the Mediterranean Mamluk Sultanate, and also the Indian Mamluks dynasty during the time of the Delhi Sultanate. And actually, Ibn Battuta notes this. Ibn Battuta notes that Ghiyath ad-Din ibn Tughluq had actually made it very clear that he had been manumitted before he could be the ruler. Of course, where you do see slave administrators is what you see a lot of times in Islamic history, but the clearest example is the Ottoman Devşirme system and the Enderun Mektebi, the interior school, the inner school that takes a sort of smart Devşirme boys and educates them. And they go through a series of tests and eventually the most successful become the personal pages of the Sultan. And then they'll be educated to be the very senior administrators of the Ottoman Empire. And this is the case really through the end of the 1600s that you have, or through certainly the early 1600s that you have the senior administration of the empire are actually slaves of the Sultan. I'm to the point where there's this one case where, you know, one of the viziers tries to go and testify in court and he can't because he's a slave. So they won't accept his testimony, even though he's the grand vizier.
Let's turn to the other sort of major segment of this book, which is arguments, Muslim arguments for critiquing slavery or the abolishment of slavery or showing sort of the normative illegitimacy in the modern period or early modern period and so on. And you talk about multiple examples, and of course we will not be able to go into all of them. But could you perhaps describe some key strands of Muslim scholars and sort of key arguments, that sort of major arguments that we've seen in modern Muslim history in trying to come to grips with and trying to sort of deem slavery as no longer legitimate in Islam? What are some key arguments that have come up in regards to that? Yeah.
So, you know, you could probably do a pretty, quick taxonomy of this, which is, so the kind of starting from the section that the strongest disapproval and kind of complete moral rejection of slavery in the Islamic tradition, which is the group or the approach that William Gervais Clarence Smith calls the radical approach. This would be, it's very rare. I mean, you don't see a lot of people, a lot of scholars take it up. And those who do kind of really pay a price in the sense of how they're viewed by other ulama. One is Sir Sayyid Ahmed Khan, died 1898. He's probably the most clear. And you have kind of a strain descending from him, especially in South Asian thought of Islamic modernist complete rejection of slavery. And so what this group would say is that, what they would say is that, Islam never accepted slavery. So slavery was never morally acceptable to God and the Prophet. And that, so someone like Sir Sayyid Ahmed Khan would say that that's why the Quran always talks about ma malakat aymanukum, those who your right hands possessed in the past tense. So at the most, the Quran only kind of accepts or affirms existing slave relationships, but it makes clear that there should not be any more slavery after that. The problem with this, I mean, you get a moral condemnation of slavery. Slavery isn't part of Islam. The problem is that you essentially lose the entirety of the Sharia tradition after that. So not only that, but you lose essentially all the hadiths that deal with slavery and that seem to affirm it and legitimize it. So there's a huge cost. And of course, the real problem remains, which is that if slavery is absolute, intrinsic, gross moral evil throughout time and space, then why would God and the Prophet affirm it even for the existing slave relationships at the time? Why wouldn't it just the Quran just say slavery is evil, cannot be allowed, period, right now, finished, it's over? So the second approach, which is more popular and more accepted, you see from some Islamic kind of reformist, revivalist, like Rashid Rida, died 1935, which would say that it was not economically possible to eliminate slavery immediately, but that the Quran and the Sunnah, by restricting the routes into slavery to only capture and war, and by saying that, by really encouraging in extraordinary ways the emancipation of slaves, that basically there was going to be a very sharp trajectory set to eliminating slavery. And that basically what had happened is that Muslims had kind of gone off the rails and hadn't really followed that course and had instead sort of started enslaving people right, left, and center. So now Muslims can get back to that original historical impetus or historical trajectory of eliminating slavery as part of their religion. That allows you sort of, it explains why slavery isn't condemned in the Quran or isn't prohibited. But you kind of, Islamic history is then a history of failure, really. It's a history of failure to follow this mandate. And of course, you also don't get the moral condemnation. And this is what I asked in the book, if slavery is a gross and intrinsic moral evil throughout space and time, and if God and the Prophet could not accept a gross and intrinsic moral evil, why didn't the Quran just say, yes, slavery cannot be removed right now, but it's evil and should be removed as soon as possible? The Quran never says that. The Prophet never says that. By the way, this is exactly the same debate that Christians had over the Bible in the 19th century. abolitionist Christian said, Jesus was a sort of a moving front of liberation. He came to free everybody. Clearly, we should get rid of slavery. And sort of Christians who supported slavery or were skeptical of these arguments said, why didn't Jesus say that then? And, you know, abolitionist Christians would say, well, it would have caused too much enmity and he would have been antagonized too much. And he might have been, it might have caused a lot of trauma, to which their opponent said, well, Jesus got crucified, you know, and this is, it's not like he wasn't not trying to make a splash. So both Jesus in the Christian tradition and Muhammad are not individuals or messengers who are averse to causing controversy. So then the next kind of argument over would be this abolition as an aim of the Sharia. And this doesn't kind of reject the Sharia tradition or see it as a failure. It actually totally embraces the Sharia tradition. It says that the emancipation of slaves is an aim of the Sharia, which is pretty clear and is totally kind of indigenous idea to Islamic legal discourse. And that now that slavery is economically unnecessary and it's possible to get rid of it, that Muslims sort of the ultimate fulfillment of this aim of the Sharia would be to abolish slavery as a legal category. The benefit of this argument is that you really maintain the integrity of the Sharia tradition. You don't sacrifice it. You don't sort of impugn it as morally aberrant or misguided. But there's two problems. One is that, again, you don't have any moral condemnation of slavery qua slavery. And the second thing is that slavery doesn't really, the idea of abolition doesn't exist in the Islamic tradition prior to encounters with Europe. So the problem here is that now abolition as a moral idea can't really be legitimately found in the Islamic tradition. Now, what I think is important to keep in mind when discussing this is that abolition is not an indigenous part of any religious tradition or any philosophical tradition that I know of. No society that had slaves, which is almost every society in human history, abolished slavery prior to the 1700s. You know, and the idea of abolition was not really conceivable to societies that had slaves because it was not economically possible or was not economically desirable in any way. So, you know, in this sense, it's not like, you know, there's this idea in Western history, sort of popular Western history, that's, you know, Western history is this journey into freedom, and that there's always sort of this ember or this seed of abolition that kind of matures and blossoms in Western history. That's just not true. I mean, that's sort of part of the West myth created about itself, about its own historical development. But abolition is not any more indigenous to Christianity than it is to any other religion. Then the next argument over would be to say what I call, you know, if you can't do it right, you can't do it at all argument, which is the argument that is made by Ahmed Bey in 1846, the governor of Tunis, when he abolishes slavery kind of on British urging in his territory. And that's to say that the Sharia has certain rules for how slavery has to be done. You Muslims are not following those rules, so you can't do it at all. The next one over would be to say, and this is, you see amongst a lot of jurists like Yusuf al-Qaradawi or Mufti Taqi Usmani, who would say, you really kind of lean on the state and the power of the ruler to say that, accurately, to say that, if the only route into slavery is through capture and war, and it's the decision of the imam or the ruler about what to do with prisoners, the ruler can simply say that we're no longer taking prisoners. We're no longer taking slaves. And it's a sort of executive decision done for the maslaha or the good of the Muslim community. The problem with these approaches is that you don't get a moral condemnation of slavery. It just, ending slavery is just good policy. And finally, the last one is simply to say that actually there's nothing wrong with slavery and slavery is a legitimate part of the Sharia. And what are you guys talking about? With one interesting twist, which is that Ibn Uthaymeen, the famous Saudi scholar, I think he died in 2001. And he was asked during the 1990s, during the war in the Balkans, if Bosnian soldiers could take Serbian prisoners as slaves. And he said, technically, yes, but no, don't do it because it would be terrible PR. So, you know, it almost is sort of a cynical idea here that you end slavery just because it's for really bad PR for Muslims. What I think is really important to keep in mind in a lot of these, in fact, on all of these discussions, is that the Sharia capacity to prohibit slavery or to abolish it depends on something called taqyid al-mubah. Taqyid al-mubah means the restriction of the permissible. And so this is something that is very understudied by any scholars, as far as I know, but it's extremely important. And I think my book maybe the most research that's been done on this topic that I've seen. I could be wrong. One of my students is doing his dissertation on this topic now. So inshallah, we'll have much more information about it. But the question of to what extent and how do you justify a Muslim ruler prohibiting what was allowed, for God and by God and the Prophet. And this issue gets debated, gets discussed a little bit. It really gets discussed most that I've seen in the pre-modern period by Abdul Ghani Nablusi in the early 1700s around the issue of banning coffee shops and banning smoking in the Ottoman Empire. But then it really comes into its own as a discussion in the late 19th century and the early 20th century in the context of, guess what? Slavery, the abolition of slavery, and also the ideas about restricting and prohibiting polygamy.
Turning to chapter 6, the Prophet and Isis, two questions about that chapter. One is, Jonathan, could you explain a bit, and you talk about this in the chapter, sort of ISIS's attitudes towards slavery, and especially on the question of sex and sexuality. You make the point of how incredibly it departed from the prior sort of normative attitudes towards slavery and the question of sexuality. Could you share with our listeners a bit about what were the major reasons why you find ISIS to have departed massively from the past precedent? And then second sort of unrelated question, which also comes up in the chapter, which is you give your own opinion in terms of how does one engage, how does one wrestle with, or perhaps even overcome the slavery conundrum as you discuss throughout the book. So what is your opinion on that point?
Yeah, I mean, obviously ISIS was a huge, in some ways, like the backdrop of the book, as I think it is for a lot of discussions of slavery. In current days or in the recent times. And as I say in the beginning of the book, the problem with ISIS's argument is that it's a really good argument, right? The problem is it's like it's so devastating because it's just slices cleanly. They say, look, Muslims follow the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet, and the Quran and the Sunnah both allow slavery. And the Prophet had slaves, and the Prophet had a sex slave. So why can't we do that? And, you're saying that, slavery can only happen when Muslims capture non-Muslims in war. Well, we just did that. We just captured a bunch of non-Muslims in a war. Oh, it has to be a legitimate war declared by a legitimate Muslim ruler. Well, we have the caliph. Who's more legitimate than the caliph, right? So you sort of run out of responses. And the ultimate response, I think, to ISIS particularly is to say that, one, that you cannot enslave non-Muslims who live under Islamic rule. You can't enslave dhimmis. And although they were oppressed and, subject to purges at various times, especially during the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, Yazidis were considered dhimmis, right? So they were even in the Ottoman army later on. So you cannot, and the principle is the dhimmat al-Muslimin wahida. You cannot, the dhimma status doesn't change when a new Muslim state comes along, or a new Muslim ruler comes along, or one state conquers another. So you cannot revoke the status of these people as protected non-Muslims who are unenslavable according to the Sharia. And the only way that ISIS justifies this is the way they justify pretty much everything they do, which is to say that anybody who doesn't agree with them or acknowledge their authority or submit to them, any alleged Muslim who doesn't submit to them, is in fact not a Muslim, because why would you not submit to the legitimate authority? Oh, is it because you're from a different country, because you follow that other country's government? Well, then you're a polytheist mushrik because you are worshiping that national identity or that ruler above God and above your loyalty to Islam. So ISIS is so that's one of the reasons that they get criticized by even really extreme jihadi ideologues like Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi or, you know, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is that they are completely, they're infected. Literally, this is what Al-Qaeda says. And they say that, you know, that ISIS is infected by the disease of takfir, of declaring not people to be non-Muslims. They declare anybody who's not like them to be a non-Muslim. And this is, in this sense, they're like the Kharijites. And they don't consider any previous state or any agreement that anyone's entered into to be valid or binding for them. So that's how they are able to engage in the enslavement that they did, or they were able to engage in it. And that's why their argument is so dangerous. Now, in terms of my own views, you know, how sort of what is the best Muslim argument or the most accurate Muslim argument for abolition? I would say it's the abolition as the aim of the Sharia. Because I think, one, this is demonstrably true. I think that, as far as I know, there's no religious tradition or philosophical tradition that is as obsessed with emancipation as the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet are. They're obsessed with the idea of freeing slaves. And if they don't say that you should free all slaves or end slavery as a legal phenomenon, it's because this was not something that anybody thought about prior to essentially the early modern period. And this is important. Like, even, you know, even Spartacus and the Zanjer rebels and all these other pre-modern slave rebellions, none of them were saying we're going to end slavery. They just didn't want to be slaves. In fact, they oftentimes took their own slaves from their enemies. So, you know, the idea that, you know, Muslims have to answer for why they don't have an indigenous sort of emergence of abolition, as happens in Britain and America in the 1600s, is anachronistic. I mean, nobody has this, because it's not imaginable for human societies that have slaves. It's just not. It would be like me suggesting that we, you know, abolish like chairs or something like that. It just wouldn't make any sense. And you know, this is what Aristotle says in one in his Politics, a fascinating statement. He says, "There will be slaves until looms spin themselves, or looms move themselves, like, you know, looms for sewing fabric. Like, until they move themselves, you're going to have slaves," which is basically what happened right now. When you have slaves until you have other sources of power that you use to move things. So I think that's the best argument. And then in something that comes up kind of at the end of the book, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I'll just sort of preemptive maybe, is to say the other real issue is not just how do I justify abolition in the Islamic tradition, but how do I as a Muslim explain my moral disgust at slavery? You know, if you go to a mosque or something, and I, you know, a mosque in the US, and I say, okay, who here thinks slavery is wrong? Anybody who doesn't raise their hand is lying. Because if you live in America today, of course you think slavery is wrong. You cannot live in the United States and not have this feeling. You not feel disgusted at the idea of slavery. I have this feeling. I think everybody does. So even if you come up with an idea of, well, how do we talk about this in the Islamic tradition, how do we think about abolition, the problem is I still have in my heart or in my gut a sense of disgust at something that was allowed by God and the Prophet, and it was practiced by the Prophet. So how do I explain that? And that I talk about through just saying that, and this is, you know, maybe controversial, but also very obvious, which is that many of our very deeply held moral convictions are not the products of us sort of having apprehended or understood some trans-historical moral reality that exists above and outside us. A lot of them are just customary rights and wrongs, you know, basically things of custom, or even based on technology. Why do Americans think eating dog meat is just absolutely repulsive and morally disgusting, and some other society don't have a problem? Right? This isn't some moral reality that all humans should grasp if they use their reason or if they contemplate their nature. And a lot of things that we think about, you know, that we look down on other people for, oh, they're not clean, they don't shower, they smell bad. These are almost moral disapproval we have, whereas a lot of people just don't have access to the technologies we have for cleaning ourselves. So I kind of bring up the fact that our moral revulsion at slavery, which is sincere, is it doesn't mean that it's a moral universal. It's simply a customary wrong in our society in our time. And, you know, I know that might be controversial for people to hear, but to them, I would simply say that just because something is a customary wrong doesn't mean that that's not important. It doesn't mean that's not a profound moral conviction you hold. It just means that it's not necessarily a moral conviction that exists sort of outside of us throughout space and time. It's something that certain societies develop at certain times.
Now, as a final sort of question, Jonathan, you end the book, rather than sort of a more traditional conclusion, you end the book with a section you call Concubines and Consent. So why did you end the book on this particular note, and what point or argument did you make in this conclusion?
Well, I mean, so if slavery is sort of the ultimate moral hermeneutic challenge that Muslims and, in fact, many other religious and interpretive traditions face, then sex slavery is like the pinnacle of that challenge, right? It's because not only do you deal with slavery, but you deal with the question of consent and sex, which gets us into issues of autonomy and, of course, what these things mean in our society today. And that alone would be its own separate crisis, let alone the fact that it's combined with slavery. So I really want, you know, I don't think you can just get into that discussion without having first passed through like a whole discussion about slavery as a, how do you think about it transhistorically? What are the challenges that it presents? How do you think about, what's the slavery conundrum? So you can only, I think, even begin to unravel this after looking at all these issues. And as I said in the beginning of the last chapter, you know, there's one thing that really, you know, so Muslim scholars today, like I've heard numerous Muslim scholars, very famous ones, literally like make stuff up about this. Like they'll say that Maria was not the female slave of the prophet. She was his wife. There's just, and I demonstrated in an appendix to the book, there's simply no evidence of this. There's just no evidence that Maria was not the female slave of the prophet with whom he had sex and had a child. So this is a massive crisis. Like, I understand why these scholars almost misrepresent reality, because people cannot deal with this. Like, Muslims cannot deal with this, to think that the prophet, that this was something that happened in his life. So that's what I wanted to try and do in this chapter, was to help people understand why this is such a crisis, why it seems so irreconcilable. And I actually want to be clear. I don't think that it is possible to reconcile our late modern urban Western notions of morality with the prophet having a sex slave. Like, I don't think it is possible to reconcile these. I think these are irreconcilable moralities. And you just have to choose between the two, or you have to accept that one of them is not universal or is, you know, has exceptions to it or something. I don't think that this is resolvable. But what I do try to do is say that one of the ways that we can understand why there's such a chasm between these two moralities is because of the really sort of super loaded or intensified and extremely prominent role that consent plays in our sexual morality in kind of late urban America, late modern urban America. And I talk about some of the theorists who've sort of complicated or discussed the issue of autonomy and consent, people like Judith Butler and Leila Abu-Luhu, I'm sorry. And also more recently, Joseph Fischel and his two books, Sex and Harm in the Age of Consent. And then more recently, the controversially or provocatively titled Screw Consent. And I would really recommend those books to anybody who's interested in looking into this topic. I think it's really in queer studies where you see the most liberated and critical work on this concept of consent being done. So I just try to show that we ask consent in our sort of sexual morality. We ask it to do a lot of work that it's not really suited for. It does. It's sort of the only criterion for moral acceptability of sexual relationships for us. And so we ask it to do a huge amount of work. It doesn't. It's the only agent sort of that does any work on this issue for us, and that puts us into a number of really fragile or tenuous situations in terms of how we think morally about a lot of relationships. And so I'm not criticizing this. I'm simply saying that I think this is a fairly accurate understanding of our late modern urban Western morality, and that if we were to look throughout human history at sort of different moralities around sex, ours would be the furthest away from kind of it's an outlier. And so one of the reasons we see this chasm between us and something like the Quranic or Sharia conceptualization of sex slavery and consent is simply because there's a abnormally large distance between those two. And finally, I end with kind of my own theory, which is that actually there is. You know, it might not satisfy critics, but I think that the Islamic legal tradition does actually accomplishes a lot of the same things as our notion of consent does. It simply does through the concept of harm. So, yes, in theory, you cannot. There's no such thing as marital rape in Islamic law because the wife's consent is already assumed as part of the marriage relationship. Or there's no such thing as marital rape between a male slave owner and his female slave because her consent is irrelevant. This is in the Islamic tradition. But that if you actually look at not just the kind of the black letter law and fiqh manuals, but also fatwas and also court cases, and I bring a lot of examples of these, that in fact, wives and female concubines could have their husband/owner's sexual access to them restricted if they said that this was harming them, was causing them physical harm or discomfort or something. So what we would kind of see as being done by the concept of consent, Muslim jurists get done through the concept of harm.
So as we're coming to the end of our time, Jonathan, could you share with our listeners a bit about what's the next project you're working on now?
Yeah. The project I'm working on next is, well, the one I was working on before I started doing this one, and it's sort of been sitting on the back burner. It's almost done, actually, which is a kind of a history of the mazalim or mazalim courts in Islamic civilization. And I do a critical edition of a Persian treatise on this, and I translate the treatise, and I do an analysis of it. It's about the mazalim courts, but it's really uses that as a way to talk about a bigger issue, which is how Muslims deal with the dissonance between the kind of fiqh or the sort of the fiqh of the kind of functioning of Islamic law and their expectation of justice. So what happens when the Islamic legal tradition produces results that seem unjust, and how do Muslims deal with that theoretically, and then how do they deal with it practically? And so the Mazalim Court is one of the tools that's used to deal with that. So that's one of the maybe use the concept of Mazalim Court to talk about this tension, or how Muslims conceptualize and deal with the tension between the Sharia or fiqh and their expectations of justice.
Slavery and Islam by Professor Jonathan Brown, published by One World Press in 2019. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for your time and for this great conversation, which I'm sure our listeners will really benefit from. And again, for writing such an encyclopedic and majestic book that I'm sure will spark a lot of conversations and will be read widely and avidly. So thanks again for coming on New Books Network.
Well, thank you, and thanks for your patience.
So this was my conversation with Professor Jonathan Brown about slavery in Islam. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. And I hope you will also join us next time for another fresh episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.